ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, AI the Australian way. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese opens the Office of Artificial Intelligence, tasked with creating new standards governing the technology. The promise that we will decide what our AI future looks like and who we choose to build it. Also ahead, the words discounts and diamonds don't usually go together, but the world's largest diamond miner, De Beers, is slashing prices as demand for cheaper lab-grown versions takes off and fewer people choose to put a ring on it. And Australia's sorceress of percussion. Sounds like magic to me. The prodigiously talented, award-winning percussionist Claire Edwards joins me later this hour. It's a dramatic reversal of the Labor government's hands-off approach to AI regulation. The Prime Minister moving in a major speech today to reassure Australians that he's got their back, spelling out a range of AI regulations to help shape the opportunities, investment, and inevitable economic disruption that the AI revolution will deliver.
This is about building Australians' confidence and trust in AI and our nation's capacity to manage it, ensuring that our national interests and our national security are protected, and providing the certainty for growth, for jobs, and for investment.
And this all includes setting up an Office of AI within the Prime Minister's own office, promising to protect Australian copyright for our artists and writers, forcing data centres to cover their own power needs and costs, and ensuring that AI earns its social licence, whatever that means. Many in the AI sector have welcomed the policy pivot from the government. Not so much the Greens, though. Green Senator David Shoebridge, perhaps reflecting voter distrust of AI, says it's a missed opportunity.
What the Prime Minister has offered today is a single door in his office, no additional statutory powers, no additional resources, but a door that the big tech industry can knock on to get what they want. That is not going to deliver the protections Australians have been asking for.
Well, Johanna Weaver is Executive Director of the Tech Policy Design Institute, which is a think tank dedicated to tech policy. Last month, it released a major report on Australia's AI capabilities, taking a look at how we can shape AI rather than having AI shape us. Johanna was there listening to the PM speech today. Johanna, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks, Fran. Great to be here.
You're on the record as saying Australia needs coordinated, ambitious and decisive leadership on AI. Is that what the Prime Minister delivered today?
I think we got the first two. So I think it's ambitious what the Prime Minister set out today, and I think we should applaud that. We need that level of ambition in Australia. I think it's coordinated, and that is really important. I think the decisiveness is still to come, and that comes in the implementation. So there wasn't a lot of detail today. So that's where we're looking for the decisive action.
What's the ambition you heard?
I think the ambition is a recognition from the Prime Minister that nothing about AI is inevitable, right? AI is made by humans. We can shape AI differently. And recognising that Australia actually has a lot more power to shape AI than many people recognise and realise. And having that national leadership, I think, is really crucial.
So this goes back to your catchphrase of the choices we make as a nation will determine if AI shapes us or we shape it. Yeah. What do those choices need to be, and were they reflected in the Prime Minister's speech?
Yeah, look, I think the data centres, making mandatory rules around data centres is really important, right? To provide confidence that data centres are actually going to help transform our renewable energy in Australia rather than suck up all of the energy. That the data centres are going to be responsible users of water, that they'll actually bring connectivity into our regions, that they bring skills and new types of jobs into our regions. And that is what we are looking for once we get the detail around what these mandatory rules are going to be for those data centres.
I want to come back to that, but the Prime Minister announced national AI legislation will be tabled early next year. This is his plan, pending the Premier's agreeing at a national cabinet meeting that he's calling in August. Is that timeline acceptable given how fast the rest of the world is moving? Is it about right? How do you see it?
Yeah, so as I understand it, that national legislation is for data centres only, so it's not a broader set of rules.
Oh, is that right?
That's what I understand. And so I think we already have the data centre expectations, and this will be looking to formalise the data centre expectations, which are voluntary at the moment. So I think there's a clear signal that you're not going to get approvals unless you are doing this. So would it be great if we could do it faster? Yes, absolutely. But I think we have to be realistic about, we need to get all of the states, this is all levels of government that need to come on board to make this
so
happen.
So we don't have one state going off chasing a data centre and offering a different set of options.
Yeah, exactly.
What's driven this change in the government's tune, do you think? Is it the realisation of the investment on offer, such as, you know, Anthropic talking about investing $21 billion in Australia? We've also already seen Microsoft investing. Or is it the need to cement social license for political reasons as much as anything?
I think it's both, right? I think there's a very real economic opportunity here for Australia, but Australians are also quite concerned about the negative impacts on jobs. What about, how is this going to impact on the environment? These are real legitimate concerns that Australians have. But we also are we're living through one of the biggest transitions in our economy that I think we'll see in our lifetimes, Fran. So this is also about how do we actually prepare for that transition and not lose the opportunity of becoming a hub for AI and creating all of these new industries and new jobs. And if we miss that opportunity, it will have big negative impacts for future generations. So, but we also need to make sure that as we're embracing that opportunity, that we're not then having negative environmental impacts, that we're not having, mis and disinformation or scams and the very real concerns that people hold today. And that's really the balance that they're trying to hold in one hand at the moment.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the polls have suggested that Australians don't trust AI and the government is picking up on that. And I think, it clearly has changed its tune. It was going to be, pretty loosey-goosey with the regulation and now there's going to be legislation. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said just last week that an AI experiment was being run around the world without consent and that was not sustainable and not acceptable. Do you agree with that? And what are other governments doing around this?
So I think currently a lot of people feel like we have no control. And that's why I am so heartened by the speech with the Prime Minister today. He is saying we have control and I am taking control. And that is really important, right? What are other governments doing around the world? No one is doing this well. Every government around the world is grappling with how to do this. In the US, you saw the tech bros lining up behind Donald Trump at his inauguration, and he's now slapping export controls on them, having all sorts of wars with them about whether or not they can, the Department of War and Anthropic and others. You look at countries like, regions like the EU, which is regulated but is now really struggling to build domestic capability. The country that's probably doing this the best is one we probably don't want to emulate, and that's China. But what I would say from that is to take from the message is that if China can do it, they're balancing driving investment and protection and control. It is possible to do this, but we need to do it in a way that reflects Australian values.
Johanna Weaver is my guest. She's the Executive Director of the Tech Policy Design Institute, and she's joined us fresh from watching the Prime Minister deliver this major AI speech in Sydney today, outlining the government's new agenda for regulation of the AI industry. Just following up on what you said there, from the Prime Minister today, he said this new policy framework will lean heavily on Australia's interests and the Australian way. We had a lot of talk about the Australian way, Australian values. What should that mean? What does that mean when you hear that?
Yeah, so I think it means we need to pass legislation around privacy. We haven't updated our privacy reforms in Australia meaningfully for decades, so we need to do that. We need to implement a digital duty of care in Australia that provides an obligation on any tech company or any online platform that they are responsible and cannot prevent preventing harm, regardless of what that harm might be. So, anything that's reasonably foreseeable. We place these obligations on every other type of company in our society. We need to be placing those obligations on companies here.
We have something now called the AI Safety Institute, presumably to look at those sorts of issues. But what about in terms of data centres? There's been a lot of talk, and I'll come specifically to copyright here, about Australian content, so that we're not just shipping in the AI data centres that are going to be operating ChatGPT for all our searches there. How do we ensure that we get a reflection of Australian values and sensibilities and the way of seeing things without having our artists exploited?
Mm. So the PM was really strong on this today, stronger than I was expecting. So he came out and he said, Australian creatives need to be paid for their work. And if you're using Australian work in artificial intelligence to train it and to use it, you must pay Australian creators. The word he actually used was theft. And that one word to say that if you aren't paying for it, then you're stealing it, that is the very clear signal that he is, that whatever comes out of the Attorney General's review, which is currently ongoing, is going to be pro-creatives and rights holders. So if we don't protect that, if we don't protect the Australian industry, institutions like the ABC, we will lose what it is to be Australian, because it will become homogenised. So that is, in my view, one of the most important protections that we put in place, and we'll be watching very closely. There was very little detail on it, but strong signals.
Well, there's two things, isn't there? There's the copyright issue, and I'll just quote the PM. He said, not everything produced in Australia is up for grabs, not at all. Australian writers, musicians, artists and journalists must retain ownership and control of their work. Our laws will spell that out plain as day. Mm. Sounds easy. It sounds adamant. But is it? I mean, we already see this is a sticking point for Anthropic's investment, we're hearing.
Mm. So It is definitely possible, right? We've seen deals that have been made between big companies like Anthropic and rights holders. So, for example, I believe Nine News has just made a deal. Yeah. It is possible, right? The question is, how do you do that at scale for the creatives? And there is lots of solutions that are on the table. We're not currently, there's lots of powerful interests here, whether it's the media interests, whether it's the tech companies, whether it's the creative industry, which has a lot of weight, because there's a lot of support in the Australian population to say, we want to protect our actors. We want to protect the people that are creating this content. Now, there's a couple of different proposals on the table. I think it's very clear today that any kind of exemption for tech companies is off the table. The Prime Minister has very clearly ruled that out. So I think we're much more likely to have the establishment of a fund that supports the Australian creative industry, that type of direction.
Well, the industry said clearly they don't want a generic fund, because they're not a charity. They want to be at the table negotiating with the different copyright holders. Mm.
And I think it shows that the Prime Minister and that the government is listening to creatives because they haven't done that deal now. So I think it's a positive thing that they are saying, we want to work with the creative industry. We're prioritising this. It's a clear signal today. And we need to be making sure that we're getting that deal done in a way that the creative industry supports it.
I understand that, in the sense that that will protect our creatives who are already complaining and distressed because their work is getting sucked up into these large language models. But how do we create, if you like, an Australian large language model, something that does reflect who we are, rather than just a flattened out one that everyone around the world is getting, or can't you?
No, we
am I misunderstanding?
No, we absolutely can. And actually, there are companies already doing this in Australia. Main Code, based out of Melbourne, have just released a beta model of a model of a an AI model that does exactly that. But actually, Fran, if we're going to do that, what we need to do is invest in something called public interest compute. And this is to say that we've talked about data center expectations in terms of energy. We also need to, I think, carve out a compute reserve to say, okay, if you are building a data center in Australia, 10% or 20% of that compute needs to be reserved for Australian researchers, so that we can be building exactly the type of thing that you're talking about. At the moment in Australia, we don't have a lot of access to that type of compute. We have two supercomputers in Australia. They're getting a bit old and clunky. And so we need to see an investment in that compute infrastructure. And that's kind of the flip side of we need to solve the copyright stalemate, and we actually need to invest in this infrastructure. And I guarantee,
which is good for our tech
Exactly.
Engineer, our tech workforce. Right?
Exactly.
But and this should be part of the negotiation with government and the framework?
I think so. I think it has to be part of the data centre mandatory expectations.
Last month, your institute worked out something called an AI assessment tool about agency. And what it came up with when you used the tool was that Australia has more AI agency than people think if it prioritises strategically. Johanna, what is AI agency and how do we have it at the moment here in Australia?
So AI agency is exactly what the Prime Minister has done today. It's saying we have the ability to shape our future. Technology, there's nothing inevitable about AI. It's made by humans. We can make it differently. And recognising that AI is not one thing, right? So yes, there are large language models, the Claude and your ChatGPTs, but there are also lots and lots of other capabilities, things like computer vision, physical or robotic AI, forecasting, so specific types of models that help us better understand climate patterns so that we can eradicate fires before they become bushfires.
Are you're saying we've got advantages at this?
Those three things I've just mentioned are Australia has high capability and high agency.
In robotics, what is computer vision?
Computer vision is the ability for computers to be able to see like humans. So if you think about, for example, medical diagnostics, so diagnosis of cancer. Computers are now actually much better at diagnosing and recognising particular types of cancer because of Australian advances in computer vision, for example. Or another example, if we think about physical AI, why is Australia so good about physical AI? It's because we have mining and agriculture industries that have been driving this. So it's looking at the industries that exist in Australia. How do we evolve those industries to be the industries of the future? And not just looking at this narrow subset of large language models. And when we do that and zoom out, Australia has much more power and many more bargaining chips to bring to the table. And what the Prime Minister's speech today has said, he recognises that Australia has that power, more so than almost any country in the world, I would say, with the exception of the US and China, because we have so many of these advantages already here in our country. And so it's about seizing those advantages.
It's a very positive story you're telling, Johanna. Johanna Weaver is my guest. She's the Executive Director of the Tech Policy Design Institute. Let's talk about the narrow subset of data centres, because the PM did lean into this, and as we've suggested, it's probably because there's a lot of concern in the community about it. We are going to get legislation around this, and the new laws, when they come, will force operators to underwrite the renewable power they use and to pay grid connection costs. But according to the data centre sector, when we spoke to them last week here on the program, they're basically doing this already. Do our new laws need to be more demanding and more explicit when we finally get them into the Parliament next year?
Yes, I think they do. And just to be clear, I'm not optimistic in a way that isn't grounded in reality.
I'm not suggesting you are. I'm just saying it's nice to hear some optimism around this.
What I'm saying is the impact that AI has on our lives, we have the power to shape the legislation that prevents the harm. We have the power to say to the data centre providers, not just that it has to be mandatory renewable energy, but you can't turn that data centre on until you've built the renewable energy, right? At the moment, there's predictions that there will be a lag between the time at which renewable energies come on board and when some of these data centres will come online. This is the ability. These are some of the most intelligent, impressive people building these data centres. Let's use that to Australia's advantage to speed up the transition to renewable energies. So it's about saying, recognising that, yes, Australia is one of the most attractive countries in the world for data centres. How do we use that to get benefit for Australians?
Johanna, the Greens are calling for a moratorium on new data centres until legislated protections are in place. Now, if the Prime Minister can deliver what he promised today, that'll be early next year. What do you think about that call?
I understand the impetus to make that call and the attraction of saying, look, we need to slow down. But I'm also balancing, on the other hand, the opportunity cost of Australia missing out on these data centres being built in Australia.
We haven't even talked to jobs, but I think that's going to need a whole panel discussion of its own. Just finally, Johanna, the Prime Minister was spruiking this legislated response as being world leading, which, you know, I guess we'd expect him to say that. Australia's not the first to have, you know, an AI office, for instance. But what do we need to do over the next 6 months to ensure that we really can and do seize this moment for us, all Australians?
So I think this comes back to ambitious, coordinated and decisive. We need to see decisive action across or around every aspect of the cabinet table. We need to see Annika Wells ensuring that we get that digital duty of care through the parliament. We need to have copyright reform and privacy reform coming from the Attorney General. We need to see investment coming in through, whether that's Treasurer or Finance or Industry, that needs to be being driven. It's really important that Australians feel like the AI Safety Institute is being stood up with the imprimatur of the Prime Minister behind them to actually be preventing these harms. The good and the truly world-leading, I think, about what the Prime Minister has announced is not the office itself. It's actually the fact that he's saying, I'm establishing the office, and then each one of these ministers has responsibility. Often when you do that, you establish an office and the power comes into the Prime Minister. He's done both. He's saying, I'm watching and you need to do your job. And I think that's powerful.
And when he says for all Australians, is that just a loose term that we will all benefit from the investment, or something, should it be a more specific focus that all?
I think we're talking a lot about how to spread the benefits. It's one of the three pillars of the government's national AI plan. What we're not actually seeing a lot of is how do those benefits get spread. So that's things like, we don't have time to talk about skills in detail, but it's things like saying, okay, if you're building data centres in regions, let's add a skills component to that. That's actually really it's exciting about the potential of that, but it's not blind excitement. It's not going to happen unless we demand it and unless we put the right rules in place.
Johanna, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Fran.
Johanna Weaver is Executive Director of the Tech Policy Design Institute, an independent think tank dedicated to tech policy. And coming up, did you know that percussionists play all of the instruments in their section? They're also masters of special effects and the source of the rhythm, the timing, and the texture of the orchestra. No wonder that my guest tonight, Claire Edwards, is described as a sorceress of percussion. You'll find out why later this hour.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need. Please me.
Diamond producers De Beers may have coined the catchphrase diamonds are forever, but forever might be coming to an end.
Diamonds are forever.
Mining giant De Beers has just announced it's suspending production at South Africa's biggest diamond mine for 2 years, and it's made some of the deepest cuts ever to its official diamond price, as lab-grown diamonds grow in popularity and profits are shrinking. So, what's going on? Are diamonds beginning to lose their shine? Idan Golan is a diamond expert who's written extensively about the industry. Idan, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Good to be here.
Idan, why is this news that De Beers is cutting the price of their diamonds? Why is it such a big deal? Why has it sent so many ripples through the industry?
So it's interesting. What happened was that for about a year, the company sold very quietly and kind of outside of their normal selling process, a lot of goods that are very small and low quality. So the prices are low, but they sold them in massive amounts. In fact, they sold them at a price that was lower than their official price book. What we're seeing is that, in fact, what they did now, they said that they will officially reduce the price, but in reality, what happened was that they were commanding pretty much the same price. Mid-range goods were, without getting the details of what they are, mid-range goods are unchanged. The area where there was a deeper decline or reduction in price was in a surprising area, and that is in the very high-end items above 10 carats.
Right.
And it's surprising because this is where demand is growing right now. So I'm not sure why they did it, but that's what I understand from them.
So because of, as I understand it, De Beers has traditionally and famously kept the price of diamonds inflated. Is that a fair description?
Well, yes and no. It really, so diamonds are a whole range of goods. traditionally, they did whatever they could to maximize price. They had a unique position. Because their clients are contracted clients, they were kind of forced to buy. Those clients, site holders, were willing to do to buy from De Beers simply because De Beers really promised them steady supply. And if you're a manufacturer, having a steady supply is golden. And as such, they were willing to pay the premium. If you went to say tenders where diamonds were sold, prices tended to be a little bit lower. Although, you know, when demand is high, prices are high.
Is part of the strategy, though, of keeping the prices high, it to promote the idea of scarcity and maintain the status of the diamond as the most precious of gems?
That's the whole premise on which De Beers was formed. The idea was, let's keep prices of rough high. And when they became the dominant supplier, they reached more than 80% of supply by value, then they could dictate a lot of what is happening in the market. But that has changed. I mean, since the past 25 years, they are supplier of about 40%. Now they're only supplying 30% of the goods. So their ability to make those kind of stands are diminished.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is diamond specialist Idan Golan, talking about an upset in the diamond industry in the sense that De Beers, as he told us, one of the major, major suppliers of the diamond, has, for very unusually, deflated the price of the diamond to some degree. Can we take a look at the rival market? Because if you're talking about a steady supply of diamonds, I suppose the most reliable way to get that is within the lab. Lab-grown diamonds are a thing. Has their arrival diminished the desirability of the natural diamond or the mined diamond?
Well, it's actually a very interesting case because on one hand, lab diamonds are a different product in many ways. On the other hand, they are living off the desirability of natural diamonds because otherwise you could have bought any other kind of gemstone, right? And in this case, what we're seeing is, in practice, what's happening, that in many markets, in Australia, in the United States, lab-grown has become a major choice. In the United States today, there are about 20% of the market by value. And the main understanding is today is that in the consumer market, there is a whole age group, a whole demographic that doesn't care what is the origin of the diamond. And in that case, that means that the price is what's playing the main decision maker. And that's where the lab-grown business has a big advantage.
Because they're significantly cheaper.
90% less.
Tell us a little bit about lab-grown diamonds. How are they produced? Can you explain that to me in sort of relatively short form?
Well, there are two methods. One is called HPHT, which kind of imitates the high pressure, high temperature, which imitates the process in nature. So they use high pressure and high temperature to create a diamond. And the other process is called CVD. It's the more common one. It is a newer process, and it uses what is essentially a microwave system to create layers of diamond that you can. The longer the process goes, the bigger the diamond gets. And from chemically, they are identical to natural diamonds. I mean, it's good imitation of the natural process. There's a way to distinguish between them, but otherwise, they look absolutely the same.
You're a diamond expert, Idan. Can you spot the difference between a lab-grown and a natural diamond with your naked eye?
No, absolutely not.
So why haven't we seen more competition then in this area? We talked about De Beers earlier. De Beers has announced it's going to take 2 years out of production. Has De Beers missed the diamond boat? Did it move into manufacturing diamonds, lab-grown diamonds? And if not, why not?
It did. It owns a company called Element Six, And Element 6 is the considered, I'm not an expert on that side of the business, but it developed what is considered a very high capability in the other process, in the CVD process. And in fact, for a number of years, it provided lab-grown diamonds to the diamond industry, a company called Lightbox. And then they decided that it's not good for their natural business and pulled out of it.
Right. So in a sense, are they the makers of their own crisis here? Was the writing on the wall when lab-grown diamond technology took over and they failed to dominate?
Yes, I think that their goal wasn't to make money as much as to create differentiation. And they succeeded in that for a short while, and then they decided that it's not right for them.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is diamond industry expert Idan Golan. He's talking about troubles within the diamond industry. Idan, De Beers famously launched the advertising tagline, "A diamond is forever," back in 1947, which is forever ago. And that was all about cementing in the international public consciousness the idea that a diamond ring was an essential part of getting married, a forever contract. Is that still working for them?
It's the most important diamond jewelry item that is offered. The natural diamond business in general is losing market share there at a rapid rate. As I mentioned, there's an issue of demographic here. People in the ages of, say, 25 to 35 at marrying age are preferring lab-grown often. And it's one of the most painful situations for the diamond industry.
And I did see that part of the difficulties that De Beers is having is that fewer young Chinese are getting married, that there's just fewer people getting married and therefore wanting engagement rings. Could that kind of demographic shift make such a difference to an industry like this?
Absolutely. So that's happening. And in the United States, the economic situation is such that if you are in that age group, you are facing student loans payments. They want to put their first down payment on a house. And the cost of housing in the United States, it's rising at a great rate. And as a result of that, that's pushing both in China and in the United States, by the way, the rate of marrying is flat, which means that in practice it's declining because the population is growing, right? So we're looking at about 2 million weddings annually in the United States, and the loss of that segment is very much disturbing the diamond industry and De Beers.
And the preference, you mentioned that preference there from 25 to 35-year-olds for lab-grown diamonds, lab-produced diamonds. What is the price differential between a lab-grown diamond and a natural diamond?
Significant. So if we're talking, for example, in engagement rings, where there's a willingness usually historically to spend more money. So historically, in the United States, the American consumer spent about $3,200 to $3,400. And it was very steady for many years. Today, if you buy lab-grown, you're spending about $2,200. And they're getting a bigger diamond, nicer diamond, because the cost is very much reduced. On the other hand, those who buy natural are spending a lot more. They're spending $7,000 and above. So it's two very different markets today. Commercially, two very different markets.
And what about De Beers? What's De Beers' next move? It's going to halt production for 2 years. Do you think it's possible that De Beers will ultimately abandon diamond mining?
Well, at its heart, it's a mining company. So they're not abandoning diamonds. They are shutting down one mine in South Africa. It's a mine that has cost them a lot of money in expanding it, and it's not showing a return. So they're waiting for the diamond business to improve, which is a prudent move. At this point, I think they're going to reassess themselves, do a serious due diligence. The ownership is about to change. Anglo American, who owns 85% of the company, is selling its share. And the new owners will probably take it in a somewhat different direction. What is it? It really depends on who the buyer is.
So if I ask you to stare into the crystal ball, Adan, what do you see as the future for the diamond industry? Will these gorgeous stones ever lose their sparkle?
I hope not. It's a beautiful industry. It's a beautiful product. I think that there will always be demand for it. At the end of the day, I believe that it will find a somewhat new place, but for high-end jewelry, it will always be very popular.
Are you a lover and an owner of diamonds, Adan?
No, I don't own any diamonds.
Well, you certainly know a lot about them. Adan, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Adan Golan is a diamond expert who's written extensively about the industry. You're listening to the Radio National Hour.
Coming up on Big Ideas with Natasha Mitchell.
Jack Toohey was flying high. Then he crashed. But from despair came renewal and a rebellious sense of hope. He joins me at the Make Good Festival in Bundanong, New South Wales, to talk about the big ideas in his new book, Better Things Are Possible, How Rebellious Hope Will Change the World.
Big Ideas, tonight from 8 on ABC Radio National.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
If you imagine an orchestra as a living, breathing organism, the percussion section would surely be its beating heart. Without the steady pulse of the snare and the bass drums, the pitch of the timpani, or the colour supplied by the triangle, the tambourine, the woodblocks, think about it, the rest of the instruments would be adrift in a sea of sound without punctuation or dramatic flair. And the job of a percussionist is particularly unique because they play all of them. Unlike the virtuoso violinist, they are the masters of an entire section. Magicians, even. My next guest, Claire Edwards, has in fact been described as Australia's sorceress of percussion. She's a soloist and she'll be playing with the Queensland Symphony Orchestra this weekend. Claire, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Claire, were you born with the magic in you or was it hard won? What's required in making you into a sorceress of percussion?
I don't know. I mean, I started on the piano, so that's my background as a percussionist. I didn't play percussion my whole life, but as a professional, it's the only instrument I've played. And I guess as I got older, that's, you know, was when I was coined the sorceress of percussion. And I like the imagery of that.
Me
because
too.
Percussion is, it's a very visual instrument. And so it's about, as you said in your introduction, it's about this sound palette. It's about making things sound even more magical, I guess, than they would without the percussion. And so I like this idea that we are creating magic on stage because I really feel like I am sometimes.
And I've got to ask you, given that you were a pretty serious piano player, why did you self-select to percussion? What was the attraction?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I was very serious about piano and I feel so lucky that I have that background, like for me as a musician. I think it's so, so important. But I got to this point when I was kind of in early high school where I was a bit lonely. Like I just really wanted to play with other people. And I went to our kind of local Sydney schools wind ensemble and I was like, can I play piano in the wind ensemble? And they said, well, there is no piano, but you could try playing mallet percussion. So that's how I got into it. And I just love those wind band rehearsals. Like it was so loud and it was so much fun. And we just got to have so much fun playing, you know, loud things with brass and woodwind. And
what is mallet percussion? What is that?
Mallet percussion is that is related to the piano. So we'd sort of divide percussion into xylophone, glockenspiel, marimba, vibraphone, tubular bells. They're all what we would call mallet percussion. I guess because we use mallets to hit them. So they're tuned percussion. And then we have drums, you know, tambourine, cymbals, triangle, etc., that are the unpitched percussion or the untuned percussion.
Now, I've read that you've described playing percussion as requiring good organisational skills. Now, if I put that sentence together with the description you gave us before about it being a very visual thing, I'm picturing you positioning yourself on stage, organising all the things in the right order, and then moving around a lot, up and down, hitting all these different things. Is that kind of it?
Yeah, it's very much it. I mean, I think you do have to be very organized as a percussionist because we have so many different instruments that we have to play, and especially in my concerto that I'm playing this week, like it is just a plethora of stuff at the front of the stage, and I have to know where I have to go next. I have to know what sticks I have to take with me. I have to know where my music is. It has to be, you know, turned to the right page at that moment in time. I have to put my foot on the kick bass drum in time. And so there's one bit where I have to run from one side of the stage to the other in 3.5 bars, and I literally have to run. But that stuff, it's kind of exciting. And people always say to me after the concerto, like, oh, you must be so fit. And I'm like, well, I kind of am, but it's not because of this concerto. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like a one-man band. And I just love that idea of you racing backwards and forwards across the stage. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is percussionist, not just any old percussionist. She's been described as a national treasure, Claire Edwards. Claire, for the performance coming up with the Queensland Symphony Orchestra, you're playing Veni, Veni, Emmanuel by Scottish composer James McMillan. Now, this is Veni, Veni, Emmanuel, a well-known Come, Come, Emmanuel, well-known Christmas hymn, I guess. This is a percussion concerto, though. So this is composed for percussion. And I'm going to hear a little bit of you playing now. Here we go. About that, Claire. What are we hearing there?
So in that excerpt, it's not actually from the piece, but I really wanted to play the theme to remind people what it sounds like, because I think a lot of people will know this song. And if they are able to come to the concerto and hear it live, it's amazing if you have that in the back of your mind, in your ears, this song that most people know so well. You really appreciate the amazing mastery of the composer James McMillan in kind of weaving that theme through the entire concerto. It comes up in lots of different guises. And why I think this piece is just such a masterpiece is the way the composer James McMillan, has integrated the percussion part with the orchestra. So it's kind of like we're one big machine all together. And that's why I find it just such a satisfying piece to play.
Yeah, and forgive my ignorance here, but you are on stage as the percussionist, which is the lead in a sense in this concerto written for percussion, but you've got the orchestra there backing you, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So my instruments are all along the front of the stage. So obviously that's different to how it normally is with the percussion section. And then the whole orchestra behind me, and we're just this one big kind of organism together, and with the conductor, Jaime Martin, kind of holding us all together. And we just had a rehearsal, and yeah, it's so exhilarating, actually.
I was going to ask you how many instruments you play within this percussion concerto, but I'm going to have a guess because I listened to a little of it, and with my very, very extremely untrained ear, I thought I heard a xylophone, a timpani, I thought I heard regular drums, I thought I heard bongos, I thought I heard cymbals, I thought I heard something like a tin whistle, but that doesn't make sense. Have I got that pretty right? If I'm assuming what I thought was a xylophone was maybe the marimba there?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you're definitely on the right track. I think of them as what we call setups. So I have two tam-tams, and tam-tams are like Chinese gongs, right? Oh. And they're very loud and kind of like big cymbals in a way. And I have two sets of those, one on either side of the stage. And then on one side of the stage, I have a vibraphone, which is the metal instrument, kind of steeped in jazz, and the marimba, the 5-octave marimba. And then on the other side of the stage, I have the setup where you would have heard all the drums and the bongos and the cymbals and the kick bass drum. And then I have another setup where I have temple blocks, these mini little gongs, and a log drum. So that's the extent of my instruments.
Well, you've recorded something else for us, which is the drum section, all those drums you just mentioned there, of the same piece of music, Veni, Veni, Emmanuel. Why did you want to separate these bits out for us today, Claire?
Well, I think obviously people aren't going to hear the theme in this drum section, but it's interesting, I guess, to hear it alone without the orchestra because it is very virtuosic and it's also very fast and very fun. So that's why I wanted to play this section.
Let's have a listen. Very fast, very fun, and very loud. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is percussionist Claire Edwards. Claire, you are and have been very many things. We've already mentioned the pianist, but you're the director of Ensemble Offspring. Tell us about that.
Well, we are, we call ourselves a new music group. We specialise in music by living composers, and we actually turned 30 last year, and wow. I was a founding member.
Were you three when you...
Not quite, unfortunately, no. We were all in university, so it started at the Sydney Conservatorium with Roger Woodward's Spring Festival, and we've just taken it from there, and it's sort of, I mean, I guess we're one of the main new music ensembles in Australia. We tour regularly internationally, and we commission a huge amount of new works from emerging composers, also First Nations composers we've worked with a huge amount recently. And I'm just really proud, I guess, of what we stand for at Ensemble Offspring. The music is always different, always, not always challenging, but I think our listeners have to be curious-minded people. And I love what we do. I find it so inspiring, and I find the music that we are able to program and play to really kind of be the burning fire of my, musical passion.
And are you playing percussion with the ensemble?
Yes, I do.
So does that mean for some of the pieces that you're playing, do you have to kind of invent the percussion lines, or all these compositions come with percussion?
Most of the pieces, because they're written for us in the most part, they're pieces that have the instrumentation sort of integrated into them when the composer's writing the piece. We don't tend to play arrangements very much. So they're all pieces that are kind of quite bespoke, and I often get to have a say in what the instruments are that are included in the piece. So, yeah, it's a fun process. It can be a really hard process as well because, of course, all composers are very different and the way they operate is very different. But, for example, last week we had a NAIDOC Week event where we played two new pieces by two First Nations composers, Marlene Cummins and Mark Monk Ross, and we'd worked very closely with them on these works. They're very pieces that are across genre in a way that the pieces are very much influenced by their backgrounds as musicians, and it just feels like such a special and important thing that we're doing. I mean, this group of First Nations musicians that we have surrounding us now after working with them for the last 10 years is just really special, and I'm very proud of the work that we've done in that area.
Well, you're also an ambassador for Key Change, which is a UK-based initiative for gender equity in music. So is this about supporting contemporary female composers or making sure there's a balance within musical programs? What's the aim of Key Change?
Yeah, exactly. Both of those things. So I became the ambassador about 2017, and that was also the year that at Ensemble Offspring we programmed only female composers for a whole year. And why we did that was to just show the world that it was more than possible. It was an amazing opportunity to hear a whole raft of composers that mostly hadn't been played in Australia before. And So we've sort of kept going with this commitment to programming at least 50% female works, and we commission more female works actually than works by male composers. And the reason for this is that it makes a lot of sense. You know, these days all composers are gender equal, and so why is it that we would be preferencing male composers? I mean, we understand why, of course. Orchestras still play Mozart and Bach and Brahms. They are the composers that were more prevalent in that time, and I won't even get started about, you know, why and all those reasons. But now we have this this amazing opportunity to change the direction of classical music forever. And I think Ensemble Offspring, and hopefully myself as well, we've been really instrumental in this change.
And Claire, Play School turns 60 this year, and you've had the rare honour of appearing on Play School. I think a lot of musicians, and certainly I, would give their eye teeth to be on Play School. What was it like?
Oh, it was amazing.
And what were you doing?
Well, actually, I did a few different Play Schools. One of them, we did Carnival of the Animals with Justine Clark.
Oh, yeah.
So I got to play. So that was really cute. And then another one was a kind of like percussion focus for the week. So we did, me and a couple of colleagues did little percussion chamber pieces for every episode for 5 days. And then the kind of highlight was when I got to actually host one of the episodes with Eddie Perfect.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I had to memorize lines, and I played a little bit, but I was more of a host, I guess. And yeah, that was amazing. And that felt like a really special opportunity, because as you say, it's really the pinnacle of what everyone kind of dreams about doing, especially when you've got young kids, which I did have then.
And Claire, only National Treasures get to do that. Claire, look, it's fabulous to have you with us. Thanks so much. Before you go, you've played us two different kinds of percussion instruments out of the piece you're playing with the QSO, but you're also going to play for us the vibraphone, which is a metal version, in a sense, of the marimba. I didn't know these names before I did this interview. They're kind of like, both of them, very large sort of xylophone instruments.
yeah.
Tell us about this piece you're going to play for us, because it's not part of the Veni Veni Emmanuel, is it?
No, well, not this piece specifically, but I do play the vibraphone in the concerto. And this piece is a piece on my latest album, which is called Dual Attractor, D-U-A-L, Dual. I launched my album at the start of the year, and it's got a whole raft of pieces by female composers. So very topical in relation to what we were just talking about. And this is a piece by Natalie Williams, and it's based on a concerto, actually, that she wrote me a couple of years ago called Stealing Fire, and it was inspired by the Port Kembla steelworkers in the 80s who fought for their rights for equal pay. And so, as you can imagine, that concerto had lots of different metal sounding instruments like brake drums from cars and kind of clangorous sounds. And this is one of the main themes, which is just on vibraphone, and it's a piece called Ember Strike.
Claire, thank you so much for joining me. It's been such a pleasure to learn about percussion.
Thanks for having me, Fran.
Percussionist Claire Edwards. She's the director of Ensemble Offspring, and she'll be playing as a soloist with the Queensland Symphony Orchestra this Friday the 17th and Saturday the 18th of July. Well, that's it from me for today. Thank you for your company. And if you heard something from today you'd like to share with a friend or a loved one, you can find all our stories at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll see you tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Until then, to see us into the evening, here's Claire Edwards playing Ember Strike by Natalie Williams. Thank you.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.